or do they have any more power than anybody else? I think that the answer is actually no. It's just the idea of whether or not you're willing to challenge it. But Republicans that, you know, here's a perfect example. Rick Scott right now, somebody who is governor of Florida, literally did everything the NRA wanted. I mean, there was never a time that he was not carrying the
20 seconds.
Yes. So now all of a sudden he finally, at the end of his term, does not do what the NRA wants, and he still gets elected to the U.S. Senate anyway.
We're going to continue this discussion. We're going to post it as a post-show. Mike Spies, staff writer at The Trace, contributor to The New Yorker. His major expose of the NRA's finances is headlined Secrecy, Self-Dealing, and Greed at the NRA. We will link to it. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for paid six-month internships here in our New York TV studio. Learn more at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Dina Gezder, Nermeen Shane, Carla Wills, Tammy Warnoff, Sam Alcock, John Hamilton. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Amy. You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K220 HR Hood River at 91.9 FM, and K282 BH Philomath at 104.3 FM. The KBOO Evening News is next.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of The More Who Die, The Less We Care, Confronting Genocide and the Deadly Arithmetic of Compassion, on Thursday, May 9th, from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Oregon Jewish Museum and Center for Holocaust Education in Portland. The More Who Die, The Less We Care. Why does this occur? Professor Paul Slovic will discuss why people and governments ignore mass murder and genocide. His most recent work examines psychic numbing and the failure to respond to mass human tragedies. Again, that's The More Who Die, The Less We Care, on Thursday, May 9th, from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Oregon Jewish Museum and Center for Holocaust Education, 724 Northwest Davis Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Tomorrow Will Be, Friday, May 10th from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Old Church Concert Hall in Portland. Tomorrow Will Be is an all-ages event presented as the final show of Boom Art's multi-generational Festive Revolution season. This song-sharing and community celebration is inspired by the project Primer for a Failed Superpower. Following the performance, the audience is invited to meet with local activists and organizations at the Social Justice Fair. Again, that's Tomorrow Will Be, Friday, May 10th, from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Old Church Concert Hall, 1422 Southwest 11th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a special report on Medicare for All, featuring an extended interview with U.S. Representative Earl Blumenauer.
Also tonight, Chelsea Manning is released from a federal detention center, but she might be headed back next week.
And the U.S. House Ways and Means Committee issues subpoenas to the heads of the U.S. Treasury and the Internal Revenue Service in an attempt to force them to release President Donald Trump's tax returns.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, May 10th, 2019. I'm Liam Delta.
And I'm Michelle Coppola. Every Wednesday morning, the Portland City Council opens with citizen communications. Anyone can sign up to speak on any topic for up to 3 minutes. KBOO's Joe Meyer covers Portland City Hall and filed this report.
The harms done by the nonprofit housing industrial complex is a common theme in City Hall, and last Wednesday's communications provided yet another example. The anarchist zine Sprout Distro defines the nonprofit industrial complex as a system of relationships between the state, the owning classes, foundations, and nonprofit social service and social justice organizations that results in the surveillance, control, derailment, and everyday management of political movements. First up at City Hall was Charles Bridgecrane Johnson. He starts with the 50-day wait time to even address city council.
We live in a very chaotic, tumultuous world where a lot of things change in 58 days. But as Mr. Injured and Pissed Off pointed, if a current event really resonated with a citizen and they wanted to speak to the city council and they went to Carla's office, it would be in July before they would be able to address you. Now, some of you know a much better way because you used to serve as the chair of the Multnomah County Board of Commissioners, and you know that that body does much better than the Portland City Council at transparency and especially at constituent inclusion. Any person can show up the same day and request to engage publicly like this with their elected officials. But no big shock, the Portland City Council has not tried to emulate better governments. There are, however, some sad similarities in the shortcomings of the Multnomah Board of Commissioners and the here in our Portland City Councilors. Together, you fund the Joint Office of Homeless Services, which, of course, is a misnomer because it actually provides zero services. It really just funds services through other people. Primarily, it contracts through TPI, almost a single source provider, although there's Homeless Solutions and all that. Sometimes here, especially across the street at the Board of Commissioners, there are budget modifications when one bureau or department wants to adjust even half of an FTE. Unfortunately, through the Joint Office of Homeless Services and their providers, we don't have anything close to that level of oversight or accountability. Transition projects funded through the Joint Office of Homeless Services just decided to reduce their weekday service hours by 27%. So you think you're assisting homeless people, and your primary homeless service provider that used to open at 7 a.m. now opens 1 hour later and closes 2 hours earlier. Now, that place is kind of toxic, so although I did go there this morning, I didn't ask them if that means that they're now open during their formerly closed lunch hour. They used to close at noon and reopen at 1. Hopefully y'all can find out, have more resilience to deal with those people than I do, and you can ask them if they're now open from noon to 1, or if they really did chop 3.75 hours off of their open hours. And you really shouldn't be having to ask this question when the Joint Office of Homeless Services $100,000 a year director does the budget for the $150,000 annual director of transition projects. You guys should have got a white paper and a report saying how this is actually going to improve anything. Supposedly they're keeping the same number of FTEs on staff and they're going to do some miraculous super work in the middle of the day. But there's not one piece of paper because there's zero accountability. Thank you.
Excuse me, Charles.
Yes, Commissioner.
When was this decision made to cut the hours of transition?
It was implemented on Monday. I don't know anything about the decision-making process. When I spoke to the director of the Portland Rescue Mission at the Home for Everyone board meeting last week, it took him by surprise. I don't think they communicated with a single other service provider in the city, so you'll have to ask them about what their process was and when it started. But it took effect Monday morning.
So it's really going to have an impact on people.
That was Charles Bridge Crane Johnson, with Commissioner Hardesty following up. The long wait time to speak before City Council is anti-democratic. The head of our Joint Office of Homeless Services and the director of Transition Projects, Inc. are both very well paid. Last week, they reduced services to Portland's most needy by 27%, and nobody at City Hall knows. In Portland, accountability is built out of the nonprofit housing industrial complex. And this is Joe Meyer with MyKBOO News.
Our U.S. representative from Oregon's 3rd District will hold a forum tomorrow, Saturday, May 11th. He'll answer questions from the public about the Medicare for All Act. Oregon's 1st District representative, Congresswoman Suzanne Bonamici, will join Blumenauer in welcoming the author of the bill, Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal from Washington's 7th District. The Medicare for All speak-out forum will take place at Benson High School at 10 a.m. Members of the community are encouraged to attend. In a phone interview recorded earlier today, KBOO's Tammy Habteas spoke with Congressman Blumenauer about tomorrow's forum and the Medicare for All Act.
Thank you so much for joining us. So I have a couple of questions here for you. First question, I just wanted to have you explain a little bit about Bill H.R. 676, also known as the Medicare for All Act. How does this bill differ from our existing healthcare system?
Well, as the name implies, this is Medicare for All. It has been, it's interesting having, there are a variety of proposals that are out there to expand coverage. Right now, we're in a situation where we spend too much for healthcare in this country, and we get pretty mediocre results compared to the rest of the world. We have too many people who are forced to spend too much for inadequate coverage, and we still, despite the Affordable Care Act, we have some people who aren't covered at all. This would be just what it says. It is Medicare for All. It would be universal coverage. It is an effort here to make sure that we're not leaving anybody behind. We're having a forum Saturday morning in Portland at Benson High School with the author, the lead author of the bill. I've co-sponsored it, but Congresswoman Jamila Jayapal is going to be with us from Seattle, along with my friend and colleague Suzanne Bonamici. We're looking forward to having an opportunity to have a discussion with the public about this expanded concept.
Now, you did mention that in the past, and you very proudly voted for the Affordable Care Act. And so how will this Medicare for All Act help bridge the gap, like you mentioned, people that are still struggling to find guaranteed access to health care?
Yeah. Well, the Affordable Care Act was built upon a variety of pieces. One of them was to expand Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act. Others provided subsidy for private insurance. But even in Oregon, that doesn't cover everybody. This would be universal coverage. It would be an opportunity to make sure that we're not leaving anybody behind. Opportunities to streamline the administration. There's an awful lot of money that is spent currently dealing with the administration of a variety of programs. This cuts through the bureaucracy, red tape, and expense, and not spending so much money denying people coverage, but providing it to them.
In fact, like you mentioned, more money is being wasted because we don't have this kind of health care system. So how will this health system be paid? What are the different measures that are going to get, I guess, streamlined from current sections that aren't working, and how is it going to be infiltrated to the bill to work?
Part of what needs to happen is to have conversations like we will have Saturday morning, so people can dig into the details and look at it. There are a variety of proposals that have been floated. It's not going to be cheap, but on balance, if we're able to implement a universal coverage, single payer, we will end up paying less than we pay now. Now, there will be some reallocation because there are so many different ways that we pay for health care. Some pay out of their pocket, some have employer insurance, others are covered by various government programs. We will be going forward, looking at the best ways to deal with this implementation. There will be a need, frankly, to spend in some areas less money. We have, as I mentioned, the most expensive healthcare in the world. We pay as a nation about twice as much as the other rich countries pay, Britain, Canada, France, Germany, and as I mentioned, the results aren't better for all the money we spend. In fact, we are sort of mediocre compared to the rest of the world. This is part of what's going to be a a difficult, contentious battle. People have lots of different opinions. There are scary projections about how much it would cost, but I think, frankly, those are exaggerated, and they don't take full account of the potential savings by streamlining the system and having universal coverage. We pay a lot of money every year because some people get their health care too late. Too late. This will make it easier to get preventative care, and less likely that we'll have situations where, for want of a little bit of preventative care, we end up with big bills for people who have conditions that get very serious.
From reading the bill, I was noticing that there wasn't any mention of coverage for reproductive health or medical procedures for surgery such as gender reassignment. Why is that? Or is the phrasing just wrong? Am I mistaken? Could you explain that a little bit?
You know, I actually am not familiar with the with what all is in the last version of the bill. I've got it in what I'm going to be reading, and I really can't comment on that. It's something that we, you know, obviously here in Oregon, we have been proud of the fact that there are no restrictions, for example, on reproductive health. And we would work to have legislation that would embrace that same concept.
There was one other mention in the bill, and I'm not sure if you are up to date about it or not, but it mentioned that, and I'm quoting it, the Indian Health Services must be integrated into the program after 5 years. And I was wondering, why is it important to include the Indian Health Services to the program?
Well, Native Americans have some of the worst health outcomes, and the federal government has consistently shortchanged its obligation to Native people. That doesn't surprise you if you look at the history of how we've treated Native people in this country. Being able to integrate this into a program that they are fully covered, we want to make sure that there's enough time to be able to make sure that we're accommodating their needs and people can adjust to it. But it's Indian health is a very serious problem, and it troubles me that it consistently is shortchanged by the federal government, and we want to fix that with this bill.
Yeah, this bill seems like it's definitely showing the will of the people as well as the diversity of the people that do live here in Oregon. Another part of the bill, just kind of the last part I wanted to mention, towards the end of the bill, it mentions that Congress must evaluate the continued independence of Department of Veterans Affairs health programs. Now, why did it mention that the VA should stay as an independent program?
Well, the Veterans Administration is longstanding. It is specialized to deal with the many individual problems that our veterans face. It has very high satisfaction, and it already is a single payer that the federal government picks up the tab. As we are moving forward with Medicaid for All, expanding coverage, we want to make sure that we're able to see the benefit for retaining it to be separate. We want to make sure that we are not shortchanging veterans or, frankly, creating problems in their own mind for having a system that's dedicated to them where they would be folded into a new and larger system. This is one that you want to be very careful that you know what you're getting into, and we want to make sure that as we're dealing with veterans that their needs are met. If they're needs can be better met at the end of this process, if people think that it's would do what we have with the separate VA, they could consider folding it in. But this is something we want to be able to properly evaluate. You don't want to rush into it. We have a program that is working now, and in fact, if we had more Americans eligible to be in the VA, we would have better outcomes and lower costs. So this, when we're talking about a sweeping piece of legislation that would really touch most of the healthcare system, we want to make sure that we're doing right by our veterans and understanding the benefits, advantages, and disadvantages as it goes forward, and not do anything precipitous.
Now, are there any kind of checks and balances or any kind of committees that are going to be established in order to, like you said, evaluate how effective this new act could be?
Well, we're in the process of developing, refining, and exposing the legislation to the public. There will be obviously a great deal of oversight that will be exercised both by Congress and by the administration. This is an area where there's a lot riding on it. It needs to be done right. People's lives literally are at stake, and we want to make sure that it is done properly. There will be extensive involvement as we move through the process, both legislatively and with the administration.
Now, obviously, like you mentioned, this is a very important subject, and it's very important to be able to provide health care for everyone that is in need, as well as preventative health, which is very important. But I want to know, on a more personal level, what really inspired you to become more vocal about this subject?
Well, I have been involved with health care issues my entire public service career. And throughout that time, I have been troubled that we've got gaps in coverage, that there are people who end up not getting adequate coverage, and others for whom it ends up being a huge financial burden. I have been impressed in Oregon. We've done a pretty good job of trying to reform the system. In Oregon, in the metropolitan area, we have results that are better than most parts of the country. It still isn't as good as we'd like. It's still not as broad a coverage. And there are many people who struggle with costs. But I've been impressed with what we've done here to try and tackle the problems, expand coverage. Oregon has been on the forefront of this, and I've been pleased to have an opportunity in local government and the federal government to help advance that. It's critically important to the people I represent, and we've got a long way to go with reform.
And what are some of your fellow congressmen and women, what are their support like, or what are their some of their concerns about this act, which I'm sure that you're taking into consideration?
Well, part of what we are doing with this forum, we want to have these around the country. We want members of Congress to hear from their constituents, have an opportunity to share the outline of the proposal, get a chance to dig into details, to have the back and forth about the best ways to administer and finance. There's a lot of work to be done yet in terms of refining these proposals. This is the start, and the more that people have a chance to have that give and take with their constituents, with people who are involved with the healthcare system, the better we're going to be. This is hard work. I've been in the middle of a number of healthcare reform items. This would be the biggest that we've ever undertaken, and we've got a big job ahead of us.
You truly do. And just going back to the bill itself, the bill also mentioned that there's going to be a confidential electronic patient record system. How's that going to be overseen? And also, who's going to make sure that that information does not get misused?
Well, electronic medical records were mandated under the Affordable Care Act. We've been doing work ever since trying to engage this. Security issues are important, as you know. This is complex. We have a system that, for many healthcare providers, the electronic medical record system is actually cumbersome. This will be part of what will be built, is trying to have the protections built in, have people able to critique what is done, work to guarantee protections, there's I think a lot of work that we're in the process of doing right now, as we are making electronic medical records the norm. But the systems right now are there are questions about vulnerability in terms of who controls data, how careful we are, how well we can prevent hackers from hijacking our data. This is going to be one of the areas that requires a lot of work and attention.
Saturday, there's going to be a panel of speakers. Could you talk about that a little bit more?
Well, we have invited the primary author of the legislation, Congresswoman Jayapal from Seattle, who's going to be part of the program and will be explaining some of the principles. We will also be hearing from Congresswoman Suzanne Bonamici, who is a co-sponsor of the legislation and represents Northwest Oregon. I'll be part of that. We will have Commissioner Sharon Myron, who is a member of the county commission. She's also an emergency room physician herself and has been working on these issues for years. She's very talented, very informed, and is a great resource to us all. So we've got some people to make some presentations. We have some folks that will be involved with the give and take in terms of hearing comments and making reactions, being able to hear from the public, as we're working to lay the foundation for this legislation. There's a long way to go before something that deals with 18% of our economy is put in place. There's going to be lots of work to refine issues you mentioned in terms of how the economics work, how it's paid for. I'm convinced that we will be in a situation that will end up having much more cost-effective health care, but there are questions about how we're going to do that as well. So we're not pretending that this is ironclad and all the details are locked down, but we're getting a start on it now, and we want to involve people at the ground floor.
And if people have some questions or if they want to show support for this bill, how can they do that? Just go online, or what's the best method?
People can use their own social media. People have questions and concerns. We'll be entertaining those and try and get back to people. There will be more public discussion, to be sure. Opportunities for people to access the websites of all of the participants. People have no shortage about ways that they want to make themselves heard.
Well, thank you, and it's good to know that we have people in Congress that are willing to hear our voice as well. Is there any kind of last words or any comments that you'd like to make? I know our time is almost up.
We hope that we'll be able to have some of our friends join us tomorrow at Benson and be a continuing part of this discussion.
Well, thank you so much, Congressman Blumenauer. I really appreciate you taking your time.
Thanks so much.
Take care. Bye-bye. I'd like to thank U.S. Representative Earl Blumenauer for agreeing to speak with me. The Medicare for All Speak Out Forum will take place tomorrow, Saturday, May 11th, at Benson High School, 546 Northeast 12th Ave. The hour-long event will start at 10:30 and is open to the public. Engagements and questions are encouraged. Please go to dpo.org or Google Medicare for All Speak Out Oregon for more information. Thank you for tuning in. For KBOO Radio, this is Tammy Haptias.
In other Oregon news, the state legislature has voted to sharply restrict an herbicide known to kill trees. The product, known as Perspective, was effectively banned this week from wooded areas in Oregon. This could result in a standoff with Federal Environmental Protection Agency, which has declared the herbicide safe. When a state sets regulations that are more strict than the federal ones, the EPA announced in March that it may suspend a state's registration authority. Politico has reported that if the EPA decides to step in to overrule states on certain restrictions, Bayer, which recently purchased Monsanto and its product lines, could be one of the main beneficiaries of that change. Bayer Manufacturers' perspective, the active ingredient is a chemical known as ACP. State investigators found that ACP spraying was to blame for over 2,000 dead and dying pines in the Deschutes National Forest near Sisters. The die-off included many old-growth trees, and it resulted in the campaign to pass the new bill. But voting to protect the trees from the herbicide may set Oregon up for a standoff with federal regulators of Trump's EPA, which is notoriously anti-regulation.
The City of Portland and the State of Oregon announced today they're partnering to pay for the Portland Harbor Superfund cleanup. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency has spent 16 years developing a $1 billion cleanup plan for the site, which has been contaminated with industrial pollutants, including DDT and PCBs, stretching back at least 100 years. Under the new proposal announced today, the city and state will each contribute up to $12 million to finalize blueprints for the site cleanup design. Last December, the EPA announced that state and local officials had to meet certain goals toward figuring out a cleanup plan by the end of 2019. The site is located north of the Broadway Bridge and south of the Columbia Slough, between River Mile 1.9 and River Mile 11.8.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sonali. Then at 7, The Struggle with Alyssa Pariah, your friendly neighborhood agitator. Tonight's weather, it's going to stay warm, dropping down to about 56. Tomorrow's weather, going to be kind of warm for us, with highs near 90. Today in history, in 1994, Nelson Mandela was sworn in as South Africa's first black president. And so the quote of the day is indeed,